Welcome to the Shortwave Report. I'm your host and producer, Dan Roberts. The Shortwave Report is a 30-minute review of news and opinion heard on the shortwave radio and the internet in Northern California. Listening to international broadcast at home is quite easy. You could use the shortwave radio with the schedule of English language broadcast, but it's simpler to use a computer or smartphone with an internet connection. To help you with this, I'll announce times, frequencies, and website addresses at the conclusion of each series of stories. At the website for this show, that's outfarpress.com, you could listen to the past 5 shortwave reports and find advice for listening to shortwave at home. Please check out the website and tell a friend. In today's edition, you'll hear reports from France 24, Germany's Radio Deutsche Welle, NHK World Radio Japan, and Radio Havana Cuba. We will begin with France 24. First, a press review about Elon Musk being ready to support populist and former Brexiteer Nigel Farage as the next leader in the UK. The amount discussed was £78 million, by far the largest political support in UK history. Press reviews on Israel's decision to close their embassy in Ireland, primarily because the Irish government recognized the state of Palestine and divested from Israeli companies. Wednesday was the International Migrants Day. An interview with Boston University Global Studies Professor Mark Sterello. He talks about the record number of migrants in the world, especially the huge increase in forced migration. He connects the situation with the increase in nationalism and borders. France 24.
Allies making headlines, notably in the UK, Elon Musk apparently ready to make a large donation there.
You can see the headline on the front page of The Telegraph, and you can see Elon Musk front and centre. Musk ready to bankroll Farage. The billionaire met with reform leader Nigel Farage at Mar-a-Lago on Monday. Farage actually wrote about the meeting in his in The Telegraph this morning. You can see the quote: Elon Musk believes Britain is in deep trouble. He says Musk is right behind him and he's giving serious consideration to backing reform financially. The number that's been suggested is £78 million. That would be the largest donation in UK political history. According to The Guardian, Farage didn't actually meet with Donald Trump at Mar-a-Lago, but he did hold talks with future Vice President J.D. Vance. Important to note that Vance's favourite to be the Republican candidate in 2028, and the next UK general election will probably not be held until 2029. Electoral laws in Britain do stipulate all donations to political parties worth more than £500 must come from donors registered in the UK, but The Guardian say that there are avenues Musk could use to back reform. Options include going through the UK branch of X, or even by securing UK citizenship, for which his father says he's eligible because his grandmother was British.
Moving on, Leo, in an article you picked up on about the Israel's decision to close their embassy in Ireland.
I'll start in Israel, where the reaction has been varied. This is Ynet, a more right-leaning conservative publication. They say that the decision was taken after over a year of policies taken by the Irish government, including recognising the Palestinian state, divesting from Israeli companies and ignoring Hamas's crimes. Haaretz, who are often very critical of the Israeli government, unsurprisingly, have a very different take this morning. They've called the move an attention-grabbing gimmick. Ireland seems to be chosen to have been made an example of. The choice was made by Foreign Minister Gideon Saar, a man who Haaretz notes is fighting for political relevance after a collapse in public support. The speech finishes by saying it's hard to understand the logic behind closing an embassy while maintaining the ones in Madrid, in Oslo, where the governments hold similar positions. I'll go to the Irish press next. The Irish Independent reporting that Taoiseach Simon Harris has expressed his deep disappointment at the decision. This editorial ends with: Ireland's stance on Israel's actions in Gaza is not driven by malice. Sometimes the best friends are those who are not afraid to tell uncomfortable truths. The Irish Times next. In this piece, they make the point that this so-called gimmick may actually be linked with saving money. In September, the Israeli finance minister said that in order to fund Israel's ongoing war in Gaza, he planned broad spending reductions of about 9 billion euro in 2025. And yesterday, Israel announced plans to open an embassy in Moldova in 2025, which suggests that the Irish closure may be linked with redistributing diplomatic resources to more friendly Israel, pro-Israel countries.
Today, Wednesday, December 18th, is International Migrants Day, a day to raise awareness about the challenges and difficulties for migrants today. We're going to talk more about this now in detail with my guest, Mark Storella, professor at Boston University. If you were just to start, can you give us the layout of the situation today for migrants around the world?
Migration is one of the mega trends of this century. It's a phenomenon that we're going to be dealing with for the rest of the century. Right now, about 281 million people are migrants in the world. That means they've crossed borders. But that's normal. That's orderly. Those are people going for jobs and education and so forth. But what's really impressive is the number of forcibly displaced, people who are persecuted, fleeing conflict, and who are leaving their homes because they must. And that number now stands, according to UNHCR, at 117 million in the world. And that's up from just 33 million just 10 years ago. So the number keeps going up. And generally, refugees aren't going home.
Would you say that all refugees around the world are treated the same?
Refugees are treated differently depending on their circumstances, where they are, and what attention the international community pays to them. So, for instance, the international community has generated something over $28 billion in humanitarian assistance in the last year. But certain crises, like the crisis in Ukraine, attract most of that attention, and especially because those crises are close to countries that are big donors, like Germany and France and the United States. So there's a lot going on in just a few places. If you go to countries that are farther from the centers that are generating all this donor money, mostly in Africa, frequently those folks receive very little assistance from the international community. And they don't have even basics. They don't even have food and shelter frequently. So really, there's a huge difference amongst refugees in different places. I would also add that there's a difference in the way countries treat refugees. Frequently, some countries will provide lots of assistance. Turkey is doing a fantastic job with Syrian refugees, but other countries are unable to. Lebanon has done a great job within its means, but has very few means to support refugees.
Which migrant crises have been the most forgotten?
You know, countries have to, the international community has to prioritize where it will spend its attention. I worked hard on the Rohingya refugee crisis in Bangladesh and Myanmar. Those refugees fled over a million, and initially there was an enormous outpouring of support for them. But now that support is beginning to dwindle. What we see is that the appeals put out by the United Nations, which were initially funded at something like 80% of what was required, are now dwindling down to more like 40% of what is required. If we look at a lot of the crises in Africa, including Sudan, which is an emerging mega crisis, the support is even less. And in many of those cases, it's hard to get to those locations as well. So we have some important trends going on in terms of the level of support for migrants around the world, but also really big political trends that are affecting the way people look at migrants and refugees.
About that, I mean, looking toward the future, how could those trends, the politics of today, affect the future of migration?
One of the things that we're seeing, whether in the United States or in Europe, or for that matter, in India, in Turkey, and other parts of the world, is an increasing level of identification with nationalism and borders. It is most striking that Donald Trump in 2015, when he announced his campaign, the main plank of that campaign was about the problem of migration. And he ran on that again this year and was elected. In Europe, we saw Angela Merkel make a decision to admit 1 million Syrian refugees. And shortly after that, for a number of reasons, not just that, she was no longer chancellor. And now the European Union is itself putting together a new pact on migrants and asylum seekers, which is more restrictive. So we're seeing a populist movement against refugees and migrants around the world. And that is leading to borders that are harder to cross and the likelihood that there will be less support for refugees who are in sometimes absolutely urgent need.
Mark Sterella at Boston University, thank you.
Those press reviews and interview were from France 24, which may be easily found at their website, france24.com, as well as a YouTube channel called France 24 English. They're also available at most podcast sites, as is the shortwave report. Next, Germany's Radio Deutsche Welle. Israel plans to double the population of the occupied Golan Heights, taken from Syria in the 1970s. Steve Simon from the Quincy Institute for Responsible Statecraft talks about why Israel is bombing weapons storage in Syria and exploiting the overthrow of Assad. Also, what effect would removing all U.S. soldiers from Syria have on the situation? Germany's Radio Deutsche Welle.
Israel is to double the population of the occupied Golan Heights, a disputed strip of land along the border with Syria. Israel began building settlements there in the 1970s and effectively annexed the territory a decade later. Israeli troops have moved into a buffer zone in the area since the fall of the Assad regime in Syria a week ago. Israel has also stepped up attacks on Syrian military installations, saying the new rebel leaders in Damascus still pose a threat.
Ships at Syria's Latakia port lie slumped in the water, destroyed by Israel's latest airstrikes. Since the collapse of Bashar al-Assad's regime, Israel's military is estimated to have struck Syria more than 450 times. It says it aims to keep military equipment out of the hands of extremists and is targeting weapons depots and air defences. But the cross-border attacks have prompted international condemnation, including from the UN.
The Secretary General is particularly concerned over the hundreds of Israeli airstrikes on several locations in Syria, stressing the urgent need to de-escalate violence on all fronts throughout the country.
Israel has occupied most of Syria's Golan Heights region since 1967, but now it's expanding its reach, sending troops further into a UN-patrolled buffer area. They've taken over an abandoned Syrian military post. Israel claims the move is to protect its security. The rebel group Hayat Tahrir al-Sham, or HTS, which toppled Assad's regime, said on Saturday that Israel's advance, quote, threatens new and unjustified escalation in the region. But it added that the general exhaustion in Syria after years of war and conflict does not allow us to enter new conflicts. Despite their moderate messaging, Israel maintains Syria's new regime could threaten its security. On Sunday, it announced plans to double the population in the occupied Golan Heights in what it says is a bid to strengthen the state of Israel.
Okay, Stephen Simon is with the Quincy Institute for Responsible Statecraft. He previously served on the National Security Council during the Clinton and Obama administrations. Thanks for joining us. To what extent is Israel exploiting the power switchover in Syria to its own advantage?
Well, of course, it's exploiting the situation in Syria to its advantage. From an Israeli perspective, it would be irresponsible to do otherwise. Israel has long favored a weak and divided Syria as the best kind of Syria to be its neighbor. And that policy is simply being extended now that Assad is gone and there's this new regime. From an Israeli perspective, they want to be living next to, in effect, a demilitarized neighbor, which is why they've gone to such great lengths to destroy the endowment of weapons, especially heavy weapons and chemical weapons production facilities that the new regime inherited from the departing Assad regime.
Yeah, in that context, Israel says it sees an increasing threat from Syria. Are the new rulers in Damascus a greater danger to Israel than Assad was?
I don't really think so. Certainly not now, where you know, a situation where they lack the weapons that were once in Syria. I think you know, Ashara, you know, the guy who is now running Syria on behalf of HTS, Hayat Tahrir al-Sham, is quite right when he says that the Syrian people can't sustain another war. I mean, they've had it. And they're certainly not going to go to war against Israel at this stage. On the other hand, Israelis look at the very weakness of the new regime and they ask themselves, well, suppose there are splinter groups, more radical jihadists or Islamists who really want to take on Israel and inflict some damage on it. They have to take that view, I would have thought. I think what they're worried more about are Sunni extremists who want to attack Israel now that they've managed to seize Syria from Assad. I don't think that HTS itself, the group that is ruling Syria in the wake of Assad's departure, wants to do this. I very much doubt it. But I also question, and the Israelis probably question, the ability of the new government to control all of the forces that were part of the coalition they led to bring down Assad. And if they can't control them all, there might be some who want to, now that they're flush with victory over the Assad regime, want to, you know, start attacking Israel. And HTS understands that this is not a good thing because it will give Israel the excuse to advance territorial gains that Israel has already made at Syria's expense since Assad's departure.
Donald Trump is coming into the White House very soon now. He said that Syria is not America's fight. What's his incoming presidency going to mean for Syria and for this whole situation?
I think the main implication for Syria will be the question whether the United States removes the 900 soldiers and Marines it now has deployed to Syria. Trump would like to remove them, and if they are removed, it will leave the Kurds, the Syrian Kurds, very exposed. And that will have a serious effect on the future of Syrian Kurds. So that's a key factor. But I think that's actually the main factor. Additionally, you know, the United States actually controls Syrian oil resources, and it gives those oil resources to the Kurds. So if the U.S. left Syria, then it would mean that the new regime would have access to the revenue from its own oil, and that would redound to the benefit not just of the Syrian regime, but also the Syrian people who badly need that money.
Stephen Simon of the Quincy Institute, thanks for being on DW.
That interview is from Germany's Radio Deutsche Welle, which may be heard at a combined audio-video website, dw.com, as well as on YouTube at their channels called DW News and DW Documentary. They are also available at most podcast sites. On to NHK World Radio Japan. Taiwan has received their first shipment of military tanks from the United States. The South Korean president was impeached for declaring martial law, and a court will have a trial on removing him from power. NHK Japan.
Taiwan has received its first shipment of advanced M1 Abrams battle tanks from the United States. They're part of the 108 units approved for sale during the first administration of Donald Trump in 2019. Taiwan's Ministry of National Defense says 38 M1A2T Abrams tanks arrived early Monday morning at the Armor Training Command in Hsinchu County. A number of trailer trucks were seen outside the facility carrying what appeared to be covered M1 Abrams tanks. According to the ministry, the tanks feature high attack capabilities with a 120-millimeter gun and can reach a maximum speed of 67 kilometers per hour. Taiwan acquired the tanks as part of an effort to modernize equipment and strengthen defense capabilities. Taiwan media outlets are reporting that 42 more units will be delivered in 2025, followed by 28 in 2026. The shipment comes as China has been ramping up military pressure on Taiwan as it sees President Lai Ching-te as a separatist. The South Korean president's legal team says Yoon Suk-yeol will appear in court for the trial that will determine the fate of his political career. It says he denies his short-lived declaration of martial law amounts to insurrection. Yoon's lawyer on Tuesday said the team expects to explain more of its case within several days. The Constitutional Court has asked him to appear at his impeachment trial and given him 7 days to provide written answers. The first preparatory hearing is set for December 27th. The case centers on Yoon's controversial martial law declaration earlier this month. Lawmakers last weekend voted in favor of impeaching him, suspending him from office. The court's justices will decide whether to reinstate or fully remove him. Multiple teams are investigating Yoon, and he's apparently yet to respond to their summons. A joint unit of police and other investigators is waiting to see whether he complies with a request to appear for questioning by 10 a.m. Wednesday. And a team of prosecutors has issued a second call for him to answer their queries after he snubbed them over the weekend. Yoon's lawyer says the defense team will be divided into groups to deal with the investigation and the trials.
Those reports were from NHK Japan. On shortwave, they are heard at 9 p.m. at 11735 or on the web anytime at www.3.nhk.or.jp, as well as most podcast sites. All the times I announce are for Pacific Standard Time, so please adjust them to your time zone. If you have questions or comments about the shortwave report or could help support this program, like listeners in Willits, California and Cleveland, Ohio did this week, there's a link for online donations at my website, outfarpress.com, or you could write to Dan Roberts at P.O. Box 1162, Willits, California, 95490. Many, many thanks to everyone who's ever helped keep this freely distributed show airborne. Join in the fun. And if you're listening on a public radio station, please, they need your support as well. We will conclude with Radio Havana, Cuba. An international committee called Air Wars released a report on the war in Palestine. The Israeli army is installing automatic machine guns in the West Bank to prevent attacks on settlers. A viewpoint on the need for African countries to be part of the UN Security Council. Radio Havana, Cuba.
A UK-based company that tracks international awards across the globe has described as the most destructive and fatal conflict in recent times Israeli aggression against Palestinians in the besieged Gaza Strip since October last year. AirWorks said in a new report that Israel launched one of the most intense military campaigns of the 21st century after the Palestinians staged a surprise operation in the Israeli-occupied territories on October 7, 2023. AirWorks added that at least 5,139 civilians were killed in Gaza in 25 days in October last year, which is nearly four times more civilians reported killed in a single month than in any conflict the company has documented since it was established in 2014. In October 2023 alone, AirWorks documented at least 65 incidents in which a minimum of 20 civilians were killed in a particular incident, nearly triple the number of such high fatality incidents that AirWorks has documented within any comparable time frame. Over the course of 25 days, AirWorks recorded a minimum of 1,900 children killed by Israeli military action in Gaza, which is nearly seven times higher than even the most deadly month for children previously recorded by the tracking firm. AirWorks underlined that Palestinian families were killed together in unprecedented numbers and in their homes. The brutal Israeli military onslaught has so far claimed the lives of nearly 44,900 Palestinians, mostly women and children. Israel is set to deploy remotely operated automatic machine guns to the West Bank in an attempt to prevent potential attacks on illegal Israeli settlements in the occupied territory. Israel's Army Radio reported that the Israeli military has decided to install the automated weapons on watchtowers around the thousands of settlements and new entrances to protect them against armed attacks and infiltration operations by Palestinians. In a post on X, Israeli right-wing minister Itamar Ben-Gvir also said over 120,000 weapons have been distributed to eligible Israeli settlers in the West Bank. More than 812 Palestinians have been killed in the West Bank by Israeli forces or extremist Jewish settlers since the war began. And Secretary General Antonio Guterres' announcement that two African countries will join the Security Council as permanent members comes true. It will be a first step towards a long-awaited and long-delayed reform of the United Nations top body. During a visit to South Africa, Guterres said that this admission would take place before the end of his mandate. Both the Secretary General and the leaders and governments of the so-called Black Continent have called for his presence on the UN Security Council as a way of partially redressing an injustice. The Global South considers the absence of permanent members from Africa, Latin America, and the Caribbean, and developing countries from Asia to be unfair. They should be part of the relevant decisions to be taken by the UN Security Council, which is currently composed of 15 members, 5 of which have a permanent seat and veto power, and the rest are added on a rotating basis. There is an urgent need to seek a more balanced composition of the body in order to readdress the underrepresentation of nations from the Global South, which make up a large part of the UN membership. Both Africa and other countries are lobbying the UN for a truly transparent, democratic, and representative composition of the Security Council. This cannot be the case as long as the continent lacks integration, a scenario that has been dragging on since the end of the Second World War, when a large part of African states remained under colonialism and lacked a voice in international affairs. In essence, the question of the admission of two African countries as permanent members of the Security Council is linked to the long-standing demands of many speakers for the democratization of this appendage.
Those reports were from Radio Havana, Cuba. Cuba's website is working well at radiohc.cu, but there's no podcast. On shortwave, Cuba may be heard from noon to 1 p.m. at 15140, and from 5 p.m. to 11 at either 6000, 6060, or 6100. At their website, radiohc.cu, you can stream the English version at noon, Monday through Friday, Pacific Standard Time. One of my goals in producing this show is to encourage people like you to listen to international broadcasts, get a global perspective. You do have to look even harder these days because of U.S. and EU prohibitions on media. Every Thursday evening, I post a new shortwave report at the website for this show. That's outfarpress.com. At my website, you can also listen to past shows, find information for online donations. There's a link at my website along with a podcast link, and get advice for listening at home. The Shortwave Report, which is now in its 28th year of production, remains free to rebroadcast upon notification. For 27 years, the Shortwave Report's been produced and distributed off the electrical grid in Northern California using solar panels. I'm still recuperating from a spinal injury, so I'm staying in a house connected to the grid. I'm your host and producer, Dan Roberts. Thanks for listening.